Freedom doesn't need more cheerleaders shouting partisan slogans. It needs thoughtful, principled disciples of liberty.
Deep down, we all know that freedom and liberty matter. This is where we discuss why they matter.
It's time to elevate the discussion. Welcome to the never-ending quest for clarity.
This is Loving Liberty with Brian Hyde.
Hey, welcome to the Loving Liberty broadcast. Brian Hyde at your service this afternoon, and I have a very special guest now joining me. I want you to welcome Mike Meharry, who's with the 10th Amendment Center. And Mike, you and I were actually introduced by a mutual acquaintance, Suzanne Sherman, just the other day, but very pleased to make your acquaintance. And I got to tell you, I've been a huge fan of the 10th Amendment Center for some time. Welcome to the show.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I thank you for the opportunity to be on. It's always fun to chat with folks out in Utah.
Yeah, well, you know, and Mike, I wish I could say here in Utah, we take the 10th Amendment seriously. We are all about state powers and making sure that federalism is being lived up to. We're a little bit hit and miss on that, but hopefully it's just a matter of getting enough people with the right information. And this is something that you are a very integral part of with the 10th Amendment Center. Let's talk a little bit about what you do for the 10th Amendment Center, and maybe if you could describe for us more broadly, what is the mission of the 10th Amendment Center?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with that. The second question first. We can kind of sum up everything that we do at the 10th Amendment Center in one phrase. It's follow the Constitution, every issue, every time, no exceptions, no excuses. So by virtue of doing that, we basically make everybody on the political spectrum angry, because most people, their tendency seems to be, we're going to follow the Constitution when it's convenient and when it's advancing the policy preference that we happen to have. And so we reject that. And so we spent the entire Obama administration making the left angry because we were constantly harping about all of the executive overreach and all of the unconstitutional actions that happened under that administration. And now we're making the Trump supporters angry because we're continuing to point out unconstitutional actions and executive overreach and all of those things. So we basically do two things at the 10th Amendment Center. Number one, education. We talk about the Constitution. We talk about constitutional originalism. We teach the fact that the Constitution created a decentralized system with most of the power left to state and local governments, that the federal government was really supposed to be, as James Madison said, the powers were to be few and defined, and the powers of the states and the people were to be numerous and indefinite. We've inverted that and flipped it on its head. So now we have a federal government that does everything from waging unconstitutional wars across the world to telling you how much water you can have in your toilet. So we do the teaching, but we also do activism. We're involved. We're not just harping on a problem. We're not just here to make you mad. We're here to solve that problem by using a strategy known as nullification, which is essentially just using state and local power to undermine and stop overreaching unconstitutional federal actions. So we work through state legislatures on a variety of issues to try to roll back federal power and reclaim power for our state and local governments as it was intended to be.
So how did you come to be involved with the 10th Amendment Center?
Oh, that's a long story. Basically, I got involved almost a decade ago now. I was one of those folks that got caught up in the Tea Party movement. And I had this vague notion that, the government was supposed to be limited. I was a good Republican, and that's what Republicans talk about, right? We talk about limited government. We talk about states' rights. So I believed in all of those things, and I wanted to get involved. So I just started searching on the internet, and I found the 10th Amendment Center and started checking out the things that they were doing. I thought, well, this seems like a pretty cool organization, and filled out the volunteer form. And as they say, the rest is history. I ended up started off doing work for a state chapter in my home state of Kentucky, and then was ultimately promoted. I used air quotes around promoted, but to the national communications director. And, you know, the biggest thing that I've learned in that 10 years is all that stuff that Republicans tell you about being limited government's a bunch of BS. It's not particularly limited government, especially when Republicans are in control, as we can see by record deficits and spending and all kinds of things that are going on now.
I think you summed it up best when you said that the Republicans are very good at talking about limited government, talking about, you know, states' rights and states and state powers. But talk is cheap. Walking the walk takes a little bit more. And I'll tell you, here in my home state of Utah, We pride ourselves as a state. We are so conservative. We are so Republican. But few people seem to make the connection. We're big state. We're big government Republicans. And so it kind of it takes all the fun out of the idea of we're keeping government in its limited role when, in fact, we're not.
Yeah, it's interesting to watch the political ebb and flow from a position that is somewhat kind of above the fray. When you're focusing just on a principle, when you're focusing just on constitutional fidelity, and you're not really wrapped up in the left-right Republican-Democrat thing, which I was for most of my life. So, you know, I understand where people are coming from. But it's really interesting to watch how things shift. And like I said, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, it was the right that was talking about nullification, that was talking about limiting federal government, that was even pushing to roll back things like surveillance and things like that that are normally considered left-wing issues because they were afraid with the Democrats in control that that stuff could be used against them. Well, it's completely flip-flop, and now we're actually seeing people on the left embracing this idea of state sovereignty and you know, local control and being afraid of what the federal government can do with its powers. And I guarantee you that when the electoral cycle switches back the other way, it'll flip-flop and I'll start getting called a racist again by the left, and the right-wingers will start sending me their praises. And, you know, and it, I guess it'll keep going back and forth that like that ad nauseum. But the good news is, as we go along, more and more people, I think, are starting to realize the importance of the principle. And I think here's the thing I would love to leave with the audience. If they remember one thing from this discussion, whatever power you give any government, it's ultimately going to be in the hands of somebody you don't like. So whenever you're, you know, whenever your guy's in control and you're thinking, oh, this would be great if the government would do this. Now, I'm not sure if it's constitute, but we really need to do this. You always have to consider that at some point, the guy you don't like, Hillary Clinton or, you know, Joe Biden or AOC or whoever it is, at some point, they're going to have that power in their own hands to use as they please. So we always need to remember that. Somebody told me this once. I think it's a great suggestion. Never give the government any power you wouldn't want your ex-wife to have.
Ooh, that's somebody needs to write that. That should be a bumper sticker. It's
yeah,
that
for,
good.
For real, right?
It's
I can't claim it, but it's a great phrase.
Mike, I have to tell you, you can call me cynical if you want, but the fact that you get people angry at you from both of the you know, both of the sides of the political aisle. I know that there's nuance on the political spectrum, but we tend to think in binary terms, left versus right. But the fact that you're making people uncomfortable on both sides there tells me that you're probably onto something, because both sides love to violate principle as it is to their advantage politically. And so if you're making them uncomfortable, chances are you're probably speaking truth that they don't really want to hear.
Yeah, I think that politics breeds myopia. And I was, like I said, you know, I'm coming from a position where 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I was your basic down the middle, Rush Limbaugh, standard Republican. So I understand the blindness that comes from being trapped in that kind of political dynamic. But it breeds myopia, like I said. It makes you focus on the issues that you want to advance, and you lose track of the big picture kind of things. And so, you know, when the federal government is in control of your guys and you know, you like, let's say you like the tariffs, you think that's a good idea. Well, you're all of a sudden willing to look the other way when the federal government's giving billions of dollars of farm subsidies to farmers, which is basically just welfare. You're going to look the other way because you like the policy that it's advancing. And then if it was the other guy, you'd be screaming bloody murder because you don't like the other guy. We need to get our attention off the personalities in politics and off the parties in politics and say, what do we believe and what do we want government to do? And if we really want, if we really believe in this idea of limited government, if that's something that is truly a principle and a value for you, then it has to be across the board. Because like I said, once you give away a piece of power, you're never getting it back again. It's gone forever. And, you know, emphasizing again, the guy you don't like is going to have, or the gal you don't like is going to have control of that power at some point down the road. So I really hope that we can learn to grasp these principles instead of getting wrapped up in personalities. Now, I'm kind of cynical like you, and I don't have a lot of faith in that. And it seems like social media is exacerbating the personality war. We spend more time worrying about what Trump tweeted than what Trump actually did.
Yeah.
We worry more about, you know, what Obama said than the things that he actually did. I always kind of give people on the left a hard time who were anti-war until their guy was in charge of the war, you know. It's not like I don't mean to pick on Republicans, because this happens on both sides of the political spectrum. I even pick on libertarians sometimes because they like to use big government to impose quote unquote liberty sometimes.
Yep.
To me, centralization is the biggest threat to our liberty. And I don't like monopolies, and I certainly don't want a monopoly government.
Okay, we're about 30 seconds away from taking a break. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Mike Meharry, who is with the 10th Amendment Center. And Mike, when we come back, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about nullification. Something I would like to pick your mind on when we return from our commercial break is, how do we get the message out? And specifically, there are people who are actually pretty closely aligned with us, but still kind of favor their own pet, you know, big government. They don't mind tyranny as long as it has kind of a Republican flavor. I'd like to pick your brain about how we can best bring those who are already most of the way on our side over, without them feeling like, hey, you're picking on me, or you're coming off as you know more than me and you won't back down. So if you could think on that, let's touch on that when we return right after these messages. Welcome back to Loving Liberty. I'm Brian Hyde. My guest is Mike Meharry. He's the communications director for the 10th Amendment Center. And we're talking about the 10th Amendment Center, which nullification is a big part of what they do. In fact, Mike, you were mentioning that Kentucky is your home state. And I think back and I think, well, that's fitting. You know, between the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, those were a couple of the early examples of what nullification could look like in American history.
Yes, exactly. And these were documents that were written by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. So Mike Meharry didn't come up with this. And it wasn't something that John C. Calhoun came up with, you know, right before the Civil War. This was actually 1798 when we saw early federal overreach, when the Congress basically outlawed criticizing the government. No joke. A lot of people don't realize this, but that's what the Sedition Act did. It criminalized saying bad things about Congress. And so Thomas Jefferson and James Madison wrote these two resolutions that were actually passed by the legislatures in Kentucky and Virginia, and they outlined these principles of nullification. And basically what they asserted was that the states created the federal government. Therefore, in the last resort, the states have the right and the responsibility to determine when the federal government has overstepped its bounds, and that they have the right and the responsibility, as Madison put it, a duty, that the states are duty bound to interpose to stop the overreaching federal action. Now, it's interesting because when you read these documents, they didn't really say what this would look like. They didn't give us a process, but they definitely asserted that the states were supposed to be, you know, kind of the last line of defense when the federal government oversteps. And think about it. In America, we tend to think, well, the Supreme Court will fix it. But the Supreme Court is part of the federal government, right? So it's kind of dumb to think that the federal government is going to stop the federal government from doing things the federal government's not supposed to do. We have to have this state action. Now, at the 10th Amendment Center, we've adopted a nullification strategy based on something known as the anti-commandeering doctrine. And this is actually something else that James Madison laid out even before the Constitution was ratified in Federalist 46. The question was asked, you're telling us that this is supposed to be a limited government. How are you going to do that? How are you going to keep it limited? James Madison said there are a number of steps that states can take. And one of the things that he said was a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. Basically, just flat out noncompliance. We're not helping. Extremely powerful in today's political system, because the federal government depends on state and local action to do pretty much everything. And I'll give you an example that's going to make everybody in your audience that's leans right cringe. But this whole idea of sanctuary cities is non-cooperation. People don't hate sanctuary cities because they don't work. They hate them because they do work and they know that it hinders this federal action. So we can apply this sanctuary city strategy. You might hate it on immigration, but you could do the same thing for guns.
Yep.
You know, state and local governments don't have to enforce federal gun control. And the beauty of this strategy is that it is based on Supreme Court doctrine. Now, I'm not a big fan of the Supreme Court, as you probably would guess. But in this case, they have given us a beautiful tool based on James Madison's blueprint. They have said that states and local governments cannot be forced by the feds to implement a federal program or to enforce a federal law. So states don't have to do it. And when they don't, it's extremely powerful. So it can nullify, in effect, the law is not going to go away. It's not going to go off the books. But, interestingly, Utah just did this with medical marijuana. The federal government says marijuana is illegal. It is totally prohibited. And the great state of Utah stepped up and said, you know what, we're going to allow certain patients to access this medicine because we think it's more important and we're not going to worry about what the federal government says. 33 states have done this so far. So when states step up and say, we're not going to comply, we're not going to enforce, it's a powerful tool.
Believe it or not, though, there's some objections that come up from the right about how, well, now we can't pick and choose which laws we're going to obey and which ones we aren't. But that argument falls flat on its face when you realize historically that's been one of the best ways that bad laws have been overcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And James Madison, I mean, I think we can all respect James Madison as, you know, one of the great founders, one of the great political thinkers in American history. He is, after all, known as the father of the Constitution, right? Well, he said that. And when he wrote in Federalist 46, I encourage people to look that one up in the Federalist Papers, number 46. He actually said that when the government creates an unwarrantable act or even a warrantable act that happens to be unpopular, that they can take these steps. So an unwarrantable act would be obviously something that is unconstitutional, but a warrantable act is something that's perfectly constitutional that people in a state don't happen to like. So James Madison was of the opinion that states absolutely could pick and choose the laws that they were and were not going to enforce. And nobody's saying the federal government can't try to enforce them themselves. The dirty little secret is they can't. And that's not our problem, right?
Well, I know one of the things that makes the 10th Amendment Center such a valuable resource for people who are serious about government limited to its proper role is you guys are very big on knowing what you're talking about. In other words, this isn't just, it's not just bumper sticker slogans. It's not just, you know, hey, this sounds like a good idea. Let's all chant it in unison. You guys right. go to original sources and you back up what you're talking about with historical examples and precedent. And I think that makes it a very potent organization in that regard. If people just know that they can access that information, let's talk about your website and some of the resources available to people who are serious about their liberty.
Yeah, I encourage everybody to check out 10thAmendmentCenter.com. On the front page, you'll find kind of our main articles, certain things that we're highlighting. I think one of the best sources on the website, though, is the blog. And you can just click and go over to that. Or, yeah, I think you can just do 10thAmendmentCenter/blog. We highlight 2 to 3 articles every single day about what's going on in this. We call it the nullification movement. So you can actually go and see specifically policy-wise where we're applying these various principles and how they work within those policy areas. So you'll see things about the right to keep and bear arms. You'll see things about surveillance. You'll see things about industrial hemp. You'll see things about health care. All of the various issues, you can read those articles and you can understand exactly how this legislation works and what it does to undermine overreaching federal power. You'll also find a lot, especially this time of year in the summer when the state legislatures are by and large out of session, you'll find a lot of educational resources where we will go back to those original sources and write articles about the things that the founders actually said during the ratification of the Constitution. And I think that's the key time period in history. If you want to know what the Constitution means, look at what the people who supported it at the time were saying about it. That was the basis of ratification. James Madison said that is the basis upon which it is the real Constitution. So you can go and look at those things and you can understand, what does the Commerce Clause mean? What does necessary and proper mean? What do we mean by federal supremacy? All of those things were explained during the ratification process. So we try to teach those things and unearth that history that, quite frankly, we didn't learn in high school or even in college.
Okay, we're just about a minute away from our bottom of the hour break here. Mike Meharry is my guest. And Mike, I'm just going to ask you, in the time we have left, what are some of the topics that you are keeping a very close eye on? I mean, the president's tweets, that's what's getting all the attention. What should we be paying attention to?
Well, I'm really watching surveillance right now, and that's kind of one of my pet issues. We just learned that the federal government is using driver's license databases as basically a giant facial recognition lineup. So all of us are subject to being in a perpetual police lineup by virtue of having a driver's license. This is just one of the many things that the federal government has done in terms of surveillance. So we're really working hard to limit surveillance at the state and local level. And Utah has been really good on this, quite frankly, in requiring warrants and not allowing this kind of data to be shared broadly into these databases, allowing law enforcement to continue to do its work, but making sure that they're doing it with restrictions so that it's not just a giant, mining of data. So that's a big one for me that we've been focused on right now. And then we're also focused a lot on what's going on with hemp and CBD, with the recent legalization of hemp at the federal level, which incidentally happened because of a bottom-up state approach. Doing some sound money stuff, too. I think we need to pay attention to what's going on with the spending. The Trump administration's running up record budget deficits. They're spending money as if we are in the middle of a recession and we're supposedly in a booming economy. I think the economic situation is going to be something that's going to unfold in a kind of ugly way in the next couple of years. So another thing to definitely keep your eyes on.
Okay, Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center, thank you so much for being my guest. We've got to talk again soon.
Anytime. I'm happy to do it. Thank you.
Okay, looking forward to it. We will have more of Loving Liberty right after these messages. Welcome back to the Loving Liberty program. I'm Brian Hyde. If you'd like to join the conversation, 801-254-1640 is the number you can call. My thanks to Mike Meharry for joining me for the first couple segments of the hour. And I got to tip my hat to my friend Suzanne Sherman for arranging that meeting. I am grateful that there are so many people who are out there working in the cause of living freer lives. And, you know, this isn't for everybody. And I'm not saying that from the standpoint of you can't handle the freedom. I think most people can handle more freedom than they think they can, but we're brainwashed. We're taught to doubt ourselves, to think that we're dumb, we're broken, we can't handle that much freedom. And this is where the civic religion of statism starts to take such a decisive hold over the hearts of so many people in society. And I'm talking good people, okay? I'm not talking about, you know, dummies or people who are filled with a malice and, you know, a desire to go out there and wreak havoc on their fellow man. It's usually good people, people who salute the flag, people who sing the national anthem, people who, you know, feel a thrill of pride when they see the flag waving in the breeze. They're the ones who unfortunately mistake what government is doing for being the primary problem solver in our lives. And unfortunately, that comes at a very big price, because the more we ask government to do things for us that we should be doing for ourselves or that should be solved at a lower level, the more oppressive, the more costly, the more invasive it becomes. And as if that weren't enough, I mean, if you're aware of what your freedoms are, what your natural rights are, and where the proper limits are on government power, that's bad enough when you see government acting in areas that it shouldn't be doing it. But for me, the hardest part of all is the sense of entitlement that so many politicians seem to feel, like, well, I just came in here and totally complicated and made your life more expensive. Aren't you going to thank me for it? And they're serious. They want people to thank. Pat them on the back, shake their hand. Let me buy you lunch. Oh, and by all means, I will vote for you again. Why? Because you are the solver of my problems. So I have a serious question. I brought this up this morning on my morning program. I wanted to follow up with this today. Here's the question. What if charity replaced taxation? Now, if your knee jerked as soon as you heard those words, then you really need to listen to the rest of this. This is an article by Jean Vilbert. This was published on intellectualtakeout.org. I think it was originally published on the Foundation for Economic Education's website at fee.org. But listen to this. This is going to challenge some people's thinking. Healthcare, education, among others, these goods have been considered so important that most current governments make a huge effort to provide them to people with inadequate incomes. Surely it would be crazy to deny how important these goods are. Well, in a 2016 survey conducted by Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, OOIPOOI, I believe we call it, titled The 2016 U.S. Trust Study of High Net Worth Philanthropy, individuals were asked to select the public policy issues that mattered most to them. The two top issues were precisely health care, listed by 29%, and education, listed by 28%. Now, the article says, we will set here an audacious premise. Private entities sponsored by charity are normally more effective than public entities. However, is publicization through state activity the only or best way to provide those services to the poor? In other words, do we have alternatives? And in this case, how about charity? Couldn't charity replace taxation? Here, the author, Jean Vilbert, says it could, and with solid advantages. And he gives four reasons why this is the case. You ready for this? And it's moral, political, financial, and psychological. So he starts with, let's start with a moral plea. Are taxes so different from charity? Well, pulling out our wallet to donate money to a non-government organization responsible for offering health or education is different than opening our pockets for the revenue guys who threaten us. In other words, they're saying if you don't pay your taxes, you will end up in prison. We have a strong moral difference between a forced act and a voluntary act. Taxation is coercion, while charity is freely chosen benevolence. In fact, rich countries that adhere to a welfare state model and, of course, high taxation are not the most generous ones. According to rankings from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, France has the highest tax-to-GDP ratio in the world, 46.2%, followed by Denmark at 46% and Belgium at 44.6%. When we check the Charities Aid Foundation, or CAF, World Giving Index, France is 72nd on the list of generosity. Denmark is 24th. Belgium is 39th. On the other hand, Ireland's tax-to-GDP ratio is 22.8%. The United States, 27.1%. Would you believe Ireland is 5th on the CAF World Giving Index and the United States is 4th? Interesting, isn't it? Next, we can wield a political plea. Now, there's enormous risk in allowing the expansion of the state's forces, even when we're talking about areas as important as health care and education. Public education opens a highway to the imposition of cultural hegemony through indoctrination. If education is provided by several independent entities sponsored by charity, it's harder to control it. But when education is centralized in the state's hands, afforded by taxes, it easily becomes an ideological apparatus, making the dreams of Antonio Gramsci and Louis Althusser come true. By the way, you want to see proof of this? Look up what the NEA, the National Education Association, voted on for some of the resolutions brought forward by its members in its recent meeting. I mean, I think they had 4,000 delegates. And resolutions that suggested, hey, we should make our primary focus increased learning of students in the classroom. They voted it down. They shot it down. You know what they voted for and resoundingly voted for? We should make our curriculum more LGBT inclusive. That's the danger right there. You centralize education in the state's hands, it becomes an ideological apparatus. And I'm not trying to pick a fight with anybody when I point this out, but if that's not an ideological activist cause, I don't know what would be. As the author here points out, once the public forces take the responsibility for providing health care, life is made subject to explicit calculations of state power, featuring what Michael Foucault and Giorgio Agamben called biopower or biopolitics. Life itself becomes an object of concern for power. As a result, individuals see the demise of any boundaries against public intervention in their lives. The government gains the power to tell us what to eat and drink, how to drive or ride, what we can do or not, and more. And as I mentioned earlier, it does so, and the politicians do so with the expectation that we're going to come up to them and say, thank you. Thank you so much for taking all that hard work of self-responsibility out of the way for me. Next, we have a financial plea. Here we will set an audacious premise. Private entities sponsored by charity are normally more effective, meaning they are cheaper or have a better cost-benefit profile than public entities. They can do the same with fewer resources. For example, in Brazil, we have public and private universities. Research shows that a student in a Brazilian private university costs 60% less than in a public university. Maybe poor countries could do more with less money if they invested in the private sector and thought about how to promote charity instead of relying only on public services and taxation. Perhaps if the government demanded less coercively, people would give more voluntarily. The 2016 IUPUI survey asked wealthy people what they would do if taxes were eliminated. What do you suppose they said?
I'd sit back and I'd light cigars with $100 bills all day long while eating caviar.
No, that's not what they said. 17% indicated they would increase the amount they would give to charity. 6% said they would dramatically increase. 72% say they would stay the same. Just 5% say, yeah, I would reduce my contributions. In 2013, the figures were even more in favor of charity. 47% would stay the same, 31% would increase, 18% would dramatically increase. So considering this, rich people would give more money, and we can do more with less investing the money donated in the private sector. So why can't we believe charity is a financially feasible alternative? As a famous politician slogan goes, yes, we can. Now, I'm going to have to save the last plea, which is a psychological plea, for just a few moments here, because we've got a break coming up. But I think these are solid observations about what would happen if charity replaced taxation. But the hardest thing right now is to try to get through people's minds that forced charity, and you may feel good about, well, you know, I don't mind, my taxes are paying for good things to happen, and therefore I feel like I'm doing my part. But if you did not freely choose to give that money for a purpose, in other words, if you don't have the capacity to say no without something bad happening to you, then you didn't freely give it. And forced charity is false charity. Sorry, the truth hurts, but that is the truth. Hey, welcome back to Loving Liberty. I'm Brian Hyde. Thanks for joining me today. I'm talking about what if charity replaced taxation. This is an article published on the Foundation for Economic Education's website. The author is Jean Vilbert. I'm saying it with kind of a French pronunciation, probably saying it wrong, but that's the name, and I'm sticking to it. And Jean Vilbert has offered a number of pleas as to why we should consider charity replacing taxation. Among the four advantages and the four main reasons why we should consider it, there was a moral plea, a political plea, a financial plea, and last but not least, a psychological plea. Now, here the author says several social psychologists, among them Elizabeth Dunn, argue that people who give money to charity are happier than those who don't. And we can see the benefits of giving spike when people feel a real sense of connection to those they are helping and can easily envision the difference that they are making in these individuals' lives. Okay, I'm going to give a quick aside here because I want to share an example of this with you. This was something that a friend of mine had done recently, and it impressed me so much that I'm actually thinking, how can I do this in my own life? My friend said, I've been experimenting with something lately. And he says, actually, my wife was the one who started doing it, so I followed her example to see for myself. And he says, Bakersfield, California, where I live, has a growing homeless population. It's becoming more prevalent to be asked for money or to see panhandlers with signs. Now, he says, I've long known the realities and prevalence of fraudsters and professional panhandlers that prey on the charitable. But he says, I choose to give as much as possible when and where I can. Most usually, I have a couple of dollar bills that I keep with me. He says, I've even experimented with hygiene kits or gift cards to fast food places as well that I hand out specifically for those occasions. But he says, over a month ago, my wife said that she had started handing out a $20 bill to folks that would ask her for money on the street. And he says, I just about lost my mind, nonviolently, of course, and I pressed her why. She expressed that it was a kind of prompting that she'd had, and she just followed through with it. And he asked her, well, what had come of it? She said the response that people gave her was completely different, and that almost everyone she gave it to had started to cry. Now, my friend says, look, we're not wealthy, but we're okay off. And he says, and $20 really stressed me out for some reasons. $20 here or there wasn't going to bankrupt me, but it certainly jolted me when I heard my wife was doing it. And he says, when he did it for himself. But he says, I chose to do it myself. And the first person who came along was a woman collecting money for her son's gravestone or memorial stone. Now, you could tell she'd had a rough life. She'd most likely done meth when she was younger. I mean, she looked like she was in her late 50s, but he says she could have been my age for all I know. She had a printout that she brought with her to tell her story. And he says, I still don't know if it was a true story, nor do I care. But when I pulled out a $20 bill without looking and handed it to her without looking, she had the normal look of gratitude I'd come to recognize and rather expect from anyone accepting money. However, after she turned and took a few steps away, she obviously had seen the $20, and he says, I heard an audible gasp. She immediately turned around and ran after me and nearly tackled me as she hugged me really tight and immediately began to cry. She thanked me profusely and prayed enough to God to bless me in those 30 seconds to fill my quota for at least a couple of months. And then he says, we parted ways. And he says, I've had three other experiences of the same kind, each by handing a $20 bill. Now, he says, as I've thought of this, I've come to a few thoughts. First, I think for the homeless community, $20 is a mental amount that symbolically communicates that they're going to be okay for at least two meals, maybe more if they're thrifty, or for whatever supplies and a meal. And he says, I'm sure maybe cigarettes or alcohol may have been purchased, but I don't care. Second and more important, he says, $20 is definitely in what I call my ouch category, meaning an amount where I still question whether I can afford this or not. Giving enough that there's an ouch in the game, he says, I believe changes the relationship of giving to the given. It somehow metaphysically creates a moment of charity where what was given was not given out of its plenty, but out of its scarcity. Where the giver must act according to a deeper level of empathy and charity because of the ouch than they would if they were just giving from a position of plenty. He says, I believe that there is an honesty, love, and compassion that is somehow silently communicated. This doesn't have to be $20. I mean, it could be $1, $5, $10, or $100. The amount in this case doesn't matter. And finally, he says, and I already touched on this, but I think that there is a dignity in giving that ouch, that imparts to the given, because the beggar feels and knows somehow that the gift was not thoughtlessly handed over, but that it was intentional, honest, and truly imparted out of true charity. He says, in all of the cases of handing out $20, I have been hugged, except when I was handing it out from my truck on the road. But he says, I thought this interesting, that giving with the ouch elicits a physical response of gratitude and human connection. I embrace them, they embrace me. In that moment, I see them, and they see me. And he says, it has been a worthy experiment. I don't know if that touches your heart like it touched mine, but I think he's onto something. It's an experiment. I have not put it to the test yet, but I think I need to. And I'm curious, for those of you who may be thinking, hey, that does sound like an idea worth emulating. If you choose to do it, find a way to communicate with me and, you know, shoot me a message, call me up if you want to, and tell me if you have a similar reaction. Do people stop and actually give you a hug because you did something that wasn't just, you know, yeah, here, I flick a $5 bill in your direction. Get away from me, kid. You're bothering me. But you actually give them the amount of money that shows I'm willing to sacrifice for you. All right, back to the article here. The article talks about how UNICEF is such a big, broad charity that it can be hard to realize how our small donation will make a difference. So what's the matter? Well, the emotional return on investments eliminated when people give money to UNICEF. Just think about when you give your money to the state. And he says, this suggests that just giving money to a worthwhile charity or to the Leviathan isn't enough. We need to be able to envision exactly how our money is going to make a difference. And the study from IUPUI and their survey confirms this statement. Discussing the motivations for charitable giving, donors provided three main reasons. Number one, they believed in the mission of the organization. 54% said that. Number two, they believed their gift could make a difference. 44% noted that. Number three, for personal satisfaction, enjoyment, or fulfillment. 38% said that's why they would give. Furthermore, the study showed that people have the most confidence in individuals and nonprofit organizations to solve societal or global problems. Sizable proportions of interviewers held hardly any confidence in the legislative branch or the executive branch or even state or local governments. One could say that we need to find a way to show the results of tax collection and make the state better at providing public services in a cost-benefit analysis. Well, even with these improvements, what about the moral plea? Will we keep acting by force? And if one thinks people pay taxes voluntarily, well, what about the political plea? Will we keep making room for interventionism? Even though taxes defenders refuse to admit it, these questions remain without satisfactory answers. So at the end of the day, the author says, we used to think about helping others as something everybody must do, and it is. But while we think about that as a legal obligation materialized into taxes, we will remain unable to create meaningful connections between individuals and therefore unable to deal with challenges that today seem to be overwhelming, such as how to provide health care and education in poor countries. If we want to do more and better, we must stop seeing the state and taxation is the only means of doing things in society. That's a pretty powerful article. I'm going to feature this in the show notes when I post this up for podcast, and you can check it out at anchor.fm. Just look up Loving Liberty Radio Network, and you can follow this and read the original article and see what you think. But as I read this article, and as I combined it with my friend's story about what it meant to give a $20 bill to somebody who was in need, I don't know how to explain it, but it touched my heart in the right way that I felt like this is a really worthwhile message. And maybe it's not for everybody, okay? I mean, there may be some people who are just, enough. Stop trying to pull my heartstrings and, get back to talking about politics. All right, well, we'll always have politics to talk about. But I suspect that somewhere within the sound of my voice, there's at least one individual, maybe it's you, who has been looking for a way to step it up to the next level. And whether that's spiritually, whether that's ethically, whether it's emotionally, or even as a citizen, I just want to be a better influence or a force for good in my community. I just want to suggest that this might be one of those ways that you could do that. And I'm not asking you to consider something that I'm not willing to try myself. I haven't done it yet. But again, this story moves me in a way that I think I would like to. Look, I'm not trying to flaunt it or anything, but $20 doesn't come easy to me either. That's a better part of a tank of gas. That's a noticeable chunk of change. I find a $20 bill in, a pants pocket in the laundry. I am elated. It's like Christmas. So if it's hard to hand that over, think about what that means to a person who is truly in need. Again, if you decide to do this experiment, I really would love to hear from you and hear what kind of experiences you had as a result.